You're listening to Dr. Finn Pollard and colleagues on Siren FM with Past Prologue.
The word is about, there's something evolving. Whatever may come, the world keeps revolving. They say the next big thing is here, that the revolution's near. But to me it seems quite clear that it's all just a little bit of history repeating.
Ah, the wonderful sound of Propeller Heads and Shirley Bassey launching a whole new series for Siren 107.3 FM in collaboration with the School of History and Heritage from the College of Arts at the University of Lincoln. It's an exciting time, isn't it, Dr. Finn Pollard?
It is. Well, we felt very much in the present sort of political climate where there's a lot of sort of dismissing of the idea of expert opinion, that there was still a space for experts to, you know, to reflect on events and try and, I hope, not necessarily to change minds, but to give people additional perspectives on them. And when we were thinking about an appropriate topic to start with, the obvious one was considerations of historical angles on Brexit.
Absolutely. We will be hearing from Dr. Ian Packer in a matter of moments, but would you like to formally introduce the quintet of quality, including, of course, yourself, that you've brought along today for the first edition of Past Prologue?
Happily. So we have a team of esteemed colleagues from the School of History and Heritage going down the line to my right. First of all, Dr. Ian Packer. Then Professor Philippa Hoskin, one of our medieval history experts, and it will become clear later what medieval history has to do with Brexit. Then Dr. Sarah Longair, Dr. Christine Grandy, and last but by no means least, Dr. to be Rachel Yem. And we're going to go first to Ian Packer to talk a bit about the history of the referendum in Britain. And I suppose the first question is, would you like to think about what is the history of the referendum in Britain? Have we always been having them, or is it a kind of new phenomenon?
Well, thanks very much, Finn. Well, our constitution's developed over a very long time, of course, and at least since the 17th century, it's centred very much on Parliament and the idea of parliamentary sovereignty, which is that the ultimate decision-making body is Parliament rather than the people. And that, of course, doesn't leave very much space for the referendum. So it's a relatively new development in British politics. The idea, I think, was first seriously considered in the late 19th, early 20th century, mainly by conservatives who were worried that radical liberal governments might push through policies which conservatives felt didn't necessarily have majority support amongst the electorate. So some conservatives came to suggest that perhaps a referendum could be used to effectively block ideas like Irish Home Rule, you know, a devolved parliament for Ireland, or maybe that the powers of the House of Lords might be effectively preserved by introducing a system whereby when the House of Commons and the House of Lords disagreed, the matter was referred to a referendum. None of those things came about. They might have come about if the Conservatives had happened to win the 1910 general elections, but they didn't. And when the Conservatives got much better at winning general elections in the 20s and 30s, the idea of a referendum went away. And it didn't really come back into the centre of British politics until the 1970s. And the first UK-wide referendum we had was in 1975 on, surprise, surprise, membership of the European Union, or the Common Market, as it then was. And we've had a very few UK-wide referendums, only three, the one in 1975, the one last year, of course, on, again, membership of the European Union, and the one in 2011 on changing the voting system to the alternative vote. Most of the referendums we've had since the mid-1970s have been in the constituent nations of the United Kingdom, and they've focused on the idea of devolution for Scotland and Wales, the constitutional situation in Northern Ireland. And more recently, there's been another stream of referendums on local government in England. So, yes, it's a relatively recent innovation, and one we've really only had experience of since the mid-1970s.
Do you think the circumstances surrounding it sort of coming back into vogue as a mechanism in the 70s were similar to what was leading conservatives to advocate for it in the, you know, at the turn of the century, or not so much?
Not so much, really. I mean, I think the referendum really made its appearance in national politics in the mid-1970s as a way of helping the governing party resolve internal differences. So, for instance, in the mid-1970s, the Labour government was deeply split over the idea of membership of the European Union, and referring the matter to a referendum was a way of getting over that difficulty. And in a way, you could say that the referendum of 2016 allowed the Conservative Party to work out some of its internal differences over membership of the European Union too. And a number of other referendums have had similar reasons behind them. The initial referendums over Scottish and Welsh devolution in 1979, again, helped the Labour government of 1974 to 79 overcome some of its internal arguments about whether devolution was a good idea or not. And again, the alternative vote referendum in 2011 allowed the two sides of the coalition, the Liberal Democrat coalition 2010 to 2015, to take different sides on whether the vote should be reformed. So I think the main reason we've had UK-level referendums since the 1970s has simply been to resolve internal difficulties within the governing parties. I mean, they're not the only reasons why we've had referendums. There are lots of other reasons. Some of them have been to legitimate and reduce opposition to policies. One could say that the referendums on Scottish and Welsh devolution in 1997 were definitely intended to do that. Some, I think, have been intended to try and persuade people that policies being promoted in the referendum are a good idea. One might put the Scottish independence referendum of 2014 in that category. Certainly the idea of having elected mayors in 12 cities in England in 2012, the local referendum held over that, certainly was intended to try and persuade people that was a good idea. And some referenda, I think the government felt it really had to undertake them. That was certainly, I think, the case with the referendum in Northern Ireland over the Good Friday Agreement in 1998.
And do you think is this something we're going to be stuck with now? Do you think? But it's an established mechanism that is here to stay, or could we revert, as it were, to the pre-1970s sort of order where it was, perhaps something people dimly remember being discussed decades before, but wasn't actually a practical political instrument?
I think we're stuck with them now. I think that it's certainly the case that referendums tend to produce other referendums. We look back to the 1970s, the fact that the 1975 referendum on the European Union did seem to resolve the Labour government's internal difficulties over the European Union certainly led to it accepting the idea of referendums on Scottish and Welsh devolution in 1979, as a similar kind of mechanism. And certainly, I think the success of the Scottish and Welsh devolution referendums in 1997 encouraged the Labour government to hold referendums on, let's say, setting up the Greater London Authority in 1998, and very unsuccessfully, the idea of setting up a North Eastern Assembly in 2004. And I think it's now been more or less established that you can't really think seriously about changing the constitutional relationship between the constituent nations of the UK without a referendum.
Thank you.
you may be wondering why we've played the Star Wars Imperial March there, and that's because we're about to turn to Dr. Sarah Longair to talk about Brexit and the Empire. I sort of wanted to start by asking, in what ways do you think the history of the British Empire influenced the referendum debate?
Thank you. Well, as a historian of empire, there's been many interesting ways in which we can see the influences of Britain's prior connections to its imperial territories played out in this debate. I think some of it's been very explicit. There were a number of times where, for example, reviving connections to the Commonwealth and particularly the former settler colonies, which has been dubbed and talked about by some historians as the Anglosphere, as a way of reinvigorating Britain's role post European Union, has been a point of contention amongst politicians. Discussed by politicians and historians, particularly, the conservative historian Andrew Roberts has particularly pushed this forward as a very viable way of maintaining and reinvigorating Britain's role in the world. And particularly trading links with Canada, Australia, New Zealand. And he has even said that, you know, this would create an enormous community, potentially, you know, the largest in the world. There's been various discussions about whether or not this is a viable, actually, thing to federate. But even the fact that this is being discussed shows that very much this a notion of Britain's connections to its former empire are seen as an alternative, a way of seeing a post-European Union future play out. So that's one way in which we can see imperial connections playing quite strongly. And there's also, you know, interesting elements at the local level. Obviously, migration has been a huge part of this debate, and very much the we all know that one of the major forces of persuasion towards the Leave campaign was the idea of European Union migrants. And actually that being a sort of separate, and those being the migrants they didn't want, and that sort of Commonwealth migrants were being, and even Nigel Farage was saying that these were the migrants that we wanted from India and other former imperial nations. So, imperial territories. So, and that's also played out in an interesting way at the local level. I was reading about some research done on South Asian communities about whether or not they were Remain or Leave supporters. And there was an assumption that generally they would be for Remain because of the idea that migration is a good thing. And that's been the sort of perception. And it turns out that with research at the local level, this is far from being the case. And actually, many of them did vote to leave. They don't have the same connection. They haven't been brought into an idea of European Union membership. And actually, the revival of the discussions about the strength of the Commonwealth played out and had a particular traction with that community. So, I think those are two particular kind of examples where the Commonwealth has played a part. I think there's also a wider way in which the rhetoric and the discussions about taking back control feeds into an idea of making, I mean, to paraphrase things over the pond, to make Britain great again. There was certainly this, I sort of perceived the notion of Britain dealing with its diminished status on the world stage, and this was a way of sort of establishing itself no longer as something as one of a many European states, but actually trying to reassert itself. For me, it harks back to an imagined Britain of in which empire was played a very big part, an imagined heyday. And this is, you know, talk of, you know, and it plays into ideas, you know, talk of grammar schools and talk of, you know, the Royal Yacht Britannia, sort of nostalgia for this kind of area, which I think also has an element of imperial nostalgia, and particularly for Britain's former place in the world.
How far back do you think this goes? I mean, because do you think that, when empire was sort of formally ending with decolonisation, that there was then a period where, you know, nostalgia kind of receded and now it's come back? Or has there been a sort of very constant kind of endurance of nostalgia all through the period that has just spiked now?
That's interesting. I think there's been various, there's various phases of it. Another colleagues may want to comment on this, but there's Certainly, during the 1980s, there was a very strong so-called Raj nostalgia played out with film and The Jewel and the Crown and Passage to India, and that was seen that with a sort of Merchant Ivory version of the story was prominent. But there's certainly a debate about whether it ever went away, but it was just repressed because it was seen deemed to be it wasn't something people expressed during the era of decolonization. And I think there is a particular revival of it again now, and I think we do see it, and I mean not only in the media but through kind of political debate as well.
Are we seeing it in cultural terms as well now, do you think? Is there anything sort of going on comparable to that kind of, you know, Raj nostalgia of the 80s sort of alongside this political revival of sort of imperial language?
Well, I mean, there are new programs on telly. The Indian Summers was, you know, seen as an even more saccharine version of, well, in some way, a sort of version of it. I didn't watch it myself, so I can't say.
Yeah.
Okay. is that a fair summary?
Yeah.
There's a new film out at the moment about the Viceroy's house, I think it's about. These things are kind of current in a way that don't play out with how it is taught in schools. You know, you don't learn about empire hardly in school. It's only just been brought back onto the curriculum again. It exists more in a media sense and within the academic sphere, and I think there's a gaping chasm where there is a kind of nostalgia moving around amongst the wider public, which hasn't yet been defined, and I think still has great traction, and that's what we saw during Brexit.
Thank you.
With guns and drums and drums and guns, a-roo, a-roo. With guns and drums and drums and guns, a-roo, a-roo. With guns and drums and guns, the enemy nearly slew ya. Oh, Johnny lad, you do look bad. Johnny, I hardly knew ya. It's glad I am your home to stay, a-roo, a-roo. It's glad I am your home to stay, a-roo, a-roo. It's glad I am your home to stay. I'll never forget our parting day. But you're not the same lad who went away. Johnny, I hardly knew him. There was a time you had to care, a-roo, a-roo. There was a time you had to care, a-roo, a-roo. Now you've lost that joyful air, and you're weighted down with such despair. Johnny, I hardly knew ya. You seem to think that war was fun, a-roo, a-roo. You seem to think that war was fun, a-roo, a-roo. You seem to think that war was fun when first you went to carry a gun. But now your dancing days are done. Johnny, I hardly knew you. Sons again. No, they'll never take.
You're listening to Siren FM, and this is Past Prologue with the producer in association with the School of History and Heritage. And I'm Dr. Finn Pollard. And we're moving on now to explain why we have with us Professor Philippa Hoskin, our professor in medieval studies. And the reason for this is that a couple of weeks ago, the MP for Lincoln, Carl McCartney, published a blog post in which he compared the Article 50 bill with the 1217 Charter of the Forests. So we've asked our expert on charters to come in and enlighten us on this. And I suppose the first question is, can you tell us a bit about what exactly the Charter of the Forest was? And then, you know, is this a good comparison?
Right, well, the Charter of the Forest is issued in 1217 by the young King Henry III, and it's part of the negotiation at the end of Civil War. So it does two main things. It limits the amount of land that can be called royal forest, and it limits the forest law. It sort of prescribes the law of the forest. And that's important for two reasons. Firstly, because actually when you're talking about royal forest, we're not talking about areas with trees, basically. Some of it's wooded, but a lot of it isn't. It's areas where the king wants to go hunting. So that can be any sort of land, and you can well find your village is in the middle of the royal forest. And because royal forest over the 60 years up to 1217 had grown quite a lot, in fact a very great deal, over 50% of the country was now royal forest, you could have been living somewhere quite happily and then find that now you were in royal forest. Now, that is a problem because you're under the forest law, and the forest law is the king's own law. It's not part of the common law of the country. It's not part of the customary law that has developed. And that means there are all sorts of things that you can't do, and there are all sorts of penalties which can be enforced upon you. You have to keep your dogs, for example, without claws. You can't send your pigs out to feed in the area, because all these things might damage the animals that the king wants to hunt. And you can be fined, or you can actually be executed for things that you couldn't be fined or executed for elsewhere. So limiting that is an important part of that negotiation. Now, it's an inherently attractive idea then for people to think, yeah, this is about reclaiming the land for the people. Because you can see that almost anyone who lives in the royal forest then might be affected by forest law. You can't pick up a piece of stick, you're just doing, you know, you're a peasant, you don't want to be fined enormous amounts of money for collecting firewood. But if you look at the Charter of the Forest, it doesn't work. It doesn't work because it's not about the people. If you read it, it's all about the free men. Just like we learned Magna Carta wasn't all about everybody in the country, it's only about free men, and free men are less than 50% of the population. If you look at more detail of what it says for you, then it actually, the only people who benefit directly from it are barons. The bishops, the secular barons who have their own private forests, who now can be completely separate from the king. And if you look at the overall idea of what the Charter of the Forest is trying to do, then it's not, again, about the people at all. It's about two sorts of elites jockeying for position. The king, when he says this is land I can hunt on, I can run my own law, what he's saying is, I have authority, I have power, no one can prescribe what I do. The Charter of the Forest says, yes, we can limit your power, but the people who want to limit the king's power are the barons. I mean, those are the people who have been involved in the uprising against the king, that this is part of the negotiated settlement at the end of, and it's partly negotiated actually by the French prince. And these are the people whom the king, by customary law, should have been talking to. These are the people that he should have been asking advice of, that, you know, should be prescribing his rule, dealing with him, making sure that he does the right thing. So when they limit the power, of the king, what you're actually doing is increasing the power of the barons.
I mean, could you see, because my understanding of sort of the way Magna Carta is often seen is that, you know, as a beginning of a process towards, you know, more rights for more people. I mean, could you read the, I don't know, could you read the Charter of the Forest that way and explain it, you know, therefore it's, a, you know, yes, okay, it is, as you, you know, about elites at this point, but that it is, you know, starting a process that will expand rights to more people?
Well, no. The Charter, the Forest Law can be used in sort of modern environmental law, and some modern lawyers dealing with environmental law have tried to push it back. There were the same problems in some ways that there are with dealing with Magna Carta, in as much as that's not really its context, that's not really its content. But the other problem with the Charter of the Forest is it's law that doesn't work. It's completely failed law, it's a dead letter. And there are two good reasons for that. The first is that no one is very clear what ground it actually means is now Royal Forest. It says, at the accession of Henry II, well, Henry II takes over at the end of a civil war. What does it mean? The land he can claim at the end of the civil war? The land he should have been able to claim. It's even at that basic level, it's not acceptable. It's not easy to disentangle. And secondly, there's no way of enforcing it. In 1215, Magna Carta set up a group of 25 barons who were going to oversee the king, make sure he did what the charter said. In 1217, when Magna Carta is also issued, that disappears. There's no way of enforcing it. And when we look over the next few hundred years, people are constantly asking for the charters to be enforced, but there's no way to do it, and there's no evidence that really anyone is benefiting at all.
Do you think, therefore, that do people misuse it just because they don't, you know, they don't understand it, that we've developed over a long period a sort of misunderstanding of the history of all of this?
Yes, I think there's a lot of misunderstanding going on, and a lot of building upon ideas of the Charter standing for something, standing for liberties and rights that were never in it, and that's a bigger problem for Magna Carta. But because Charter of the Forest sort of comes out of Magna Carta originally, one of its clauses, part of 1215's Magna Carta, it becomes part of that, it becomes caught up in that process.
Thank you.
Now that you found your paradise, this is your kingdom to command. You can go outside and polish your car, or sit by the fire in your Shangri-La. Here's your reward for working so hard. Gone are the lavatories in the backyard. Gone are the days when you dreamed of that car. You just want to sit in your Shangri-La. Put on your slippers and sit by the fire. You've reached your top and you just can't get any higher. You're in your place and you know where you are, in your Shangri-La. Sit back in your old rocking chair. You need not worry, you need not care. You can't go anywhere. Shangri-La, Shangri-La, Shangri-La. The little man who gets the train got a mortgage hanging over his head, but he's too scared to complain, 'cause he's conditioned that way. Time goes by and he pays off his debts. Got a TV set and a radio for 7 shillings a week.
back to Past Prologue. That was The Kinks with Shangri-La. And we're turning now to my colleague, Dr. Christine Grandy, to talk about Brexit and the media, or aspects of the same. I thought I'd start off by asking you, what do you think a history of popular culture can tell us about historic anti-establishment attitudes? We obviously saw a lot of anti-establishment mood in the referendum campaign.
Yeah, no, and I was really struck by, I think, some of the continuities with the, I think, the at least in the immediate aftermath of the vote, and, you know, the assessment by, I think, a lot of and analysts and politicians that this was a protest vote, right, and that this was a protest against the establishment and against politics as it's been happening in the UK. And certainly looking back to the period that I work on in the 1920s and the 1930s, there is this really sort of strong anti-establishment culture within sort of a range of types of media. So you can see it within film to some extent, although that's quite heavily regulated by the British Board of Film Censors at the time. But you can particularly see it within novels and sort of what is identified for the first time in the 1920s as the best-selling novel. And this is really actually quite trashy fiction after World War One, and there's the villain that sort of crops up over and over again is the profiteer, and it's the profiteer who's made money off of World War One, off this thing that was considered a great tragedy by most people involved in it. But it's also the profiteer's collusion with government that is highlighted within novels by people like Sapper, H.C. McNeil, the Bulldog Drummond novels that were quite successful throughout the period, but other authors like Edgar Wallace and E. Phillips Oppenheim, and even Eric Ambler as well, in the 1930s. So, and within those stories, you know, politicians are out to sort of hoodwink the people, and they're out to profit, and they're out to really sort of suppress the voice of ordinary people. And I think you can see some, you know, that hostility sort of simmers throughout the 1920s and the 1930s. Profiteers become armaments traders in the 1930s. And then that kind of, it dies down a bit during World War II, quite a bit during World War II. But then really starts to come out again even after World War II. And even sort of those kind of fun, sort of cheeky comedies like the Ealing Studio comedies in the post-war period are actually sort of, about crime, and about sort of evading sort of government regulations and restrictions in the period, right? So I think you can see this real sort of strong current throughout the 20th century within popular culture of people expressing frustrations with political parties and political systems as they're functioning within Britain at the time. So seeing this as sort of, a much more sort of official expression of that has been simmering within popular culture, I think allows us to get a sort of stronger understanding of how those have existed for a much longer period.
Do you think when that sort of fiction and those films were being made in the 20s and 30s, was that then having an effect, in public life and, in how the press were covering politics, or how voters were sort of on the opinions of voters, or was it the other way that dissatisfaction was seeping from public life into the culture?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I mean, I think it's a mix of both. Certainly, the press is covering issues of profiteering throughout World War One, and there is, I think we have to think of World War One as this moment where a public and an audience of the press has this sort of really, I think, quite cynical awakening to the possibility of people actually making money off of warfare. And I think this sort of concern within the press then translates into these novels that sort of show this figure repeatedly throughout the interwar period. But the novels don't let it go. The press lets it go in a lot of ways. And the 1919 Profiteering Act is passed to address issues of profiteering. But the act itself is quite, it's curtailed really from its inception. And through a series of amendments, it's quite toothless very quickly. But that seems to sort of satisfy the press's interest in profiteering as a topic. But within fiction and film to a lesser extent, it's still sort of quite resonant throughout the period. So I think that sort of shows us, you know, the press kind of functioning to step away, but whereas ordinary people are still actually quite interested in reading about these sort of melodramatic stories.
So is there a kind of salaciousness with that, or rather than a, you know, it's sort of a fantasy of it and seeing them get their comeuppance in the fiction in a way that they aren't in
public
life? Absolutely,
absolutely. I mean, I think it sort of functions as a type of type of safety valve in some ways. I mean, the best example is E. Philip Oppenheim's book, The Profiteers. I think it comes out in 1921, but that features basically these businessmen who are in charge of grain production in the UK, and they run a company that's called British Imperial Grain, which is referred to by its acronym throughout the novel as BIG. And it's these two sort of conductors of BIG who are sort of the target of this. It's quite a weird story, but he's sort of this half American, half British ex-soldier comes in to sort of address this issue. He's sort of like a forensic auditor in some ways. But there's no sort of mechanics to actually prevent what BIG is doing in the period. And what culminates in the novel is this man, this hero, taking justice into his own hands and tying up the directors of BIG, and one of them actually has a heart attack and dies at the end of the novel. And a policeman who comes to investigate it just decides to turn a blind eye to the whole thing. And at the same time, a newspaper boy goes by and says, "Price of grain falling, bread affordable again," right? So it's this kind of this fantasy about sort of, you know, the right people being in charge rather than the businessmen and the politicians who are turning a blind eye. So it very much resonates with this concept of take back control. And I, you know, was quite struck by that slogan for the Leave campaign, because it sort of encapsulates a lot of the concerns of popular culture throughout the 20th century.
Thank you. I'm now wondering with my Americanist hat on whether he'd read Frank Norris and all of his treatments of sort of big business in about a couple of decades earlier. I want to bring in Rachel Yem at this point, who's one of our doctoral students in the school. I want to start off by asking Rachel, you're obviously working on a study of local and regional media and post-war immigration. I wonder what you think that can tell us about the success of the Leave campaign.
So my study can tell us a lot about how the Leave campaign were able to use their subject of immigration to gain so much support. So immigration became a defining issue in the referendum, and I saw some clear links between the way that European immigrants were constructed in the media and how black and Asian immigrants who travelled to Britain after the Second World War were represented in local media during the 1960s, 70s and 80s. Basically the way that black and Asian immigrants were represented as being a threat to regional identity and national identity, and also a strain on local services, European immigrants were constructed in this similar way during the referendum, so as a threat to services such as the NHS, education, and also as a threat to national identity and national culture. So immigration is quite an emotive issue, and I've seen this through my studies. So, for example, how Conservative candidate Peter Griffith was able to gain so much support in the 1964 general election in Smethwick, for example. So what this shows us is how the topic of immigration can be utilised quite successfully by politicians, and also the role that media plays in this. And I also think it's worth noting as well that some of the areas with the highest rate of immigration were actually some of the areas to vote to remain in the European Union. So what this tells us as well is how it was actually the fear of immigration, sometimes rather than actual interaction with immigrants themselves, that was causing people to have such anxieties about immigration. And the media obviously played a massive role in constructing these fears.
Do you think there's a sort of distinctive regional story to say, I don't know, or local story to say Lincoln or the East Midlands about both these episodes, both the you know, the period that you're researching and the sort of current moment?
So one of the things that I look at in my research is how responses to post-war immigration varied between different regions, particularly in regions like the Midlands, which had cities like Leicester and Birmingham with quite high immigrant populations. And this kind of shows the importance of looking at areas outside of London. What we saw with the referendum is that London was, I think, the only region other than Northern Ireland and Scotland to vote to remain in the European Union. So this, again, highlights the importance of looking at regions outside of London. So the kind of disparity between the results in the south and the north of England demonstrates that people responded to these threats of immigration in different ways. And it was kind of a way of people in these communities in regions outside of London who felt that maybe they weren't getting their voices heard to kind of reclaim those voices in a sense.
I want to have I got room for one more question? I want to open checking with my producer. I want to open one more question to both of you, which is this: both of you obviously work also sort of on aspects of media history, and ask you whether you think there are, you know, can we see parallels in past media involvement in political campaigns to the kind of issues that were raised about the media in the current campaign, or, you know, have we moved into some sort of new era of journalism and media coverage of big political events?
No, I think that's a good question. I mean, I think we have... I mean, I think the way that politicians have to use mass media means that they're sort of coming up against all the issues that mass media itself has addressed throughout the 20th century, right? Like, how do you secure the biggest audience, right? And how can you persuade that audience to your cause? The way that mass media in the past has bridged that, and this can be applied to the press and also film and television to some extent, is to use quite sort of simplistic language and to appeal to the emotions of ordinary people consuming that message. So, and it's the rise of the so-called human interest story, as Dan LeMahieu has argued, another historian, and that the human interest story deals in polarities for the most part, in sort of exaggerated concepts and melodrama. So there's, you know, it's about love and death and birth and life, good and evil. And so, you know, this has been used to sort of gain film audiences, to gain press audiences, to gain television audiences to some extent. And we see politicians using this as well, right? And the Take Back Control slogan was just so much more powerful than the Remain one in many ways, because it implies action, it appeals to sort of whatever anxieties people have about sovereignty, about immigration, about loss of imperial status, about jobs, right? So I think, you know, I think the Leave campaign was able to use this quite successfully to appeal to use this kind of broad kind of story to appeal to voters, but also that kind of story implies a villain, you know? It always implies a villain. And I think that's what we need to be quite attentive to going forth, is, you know, the multiple ways in which those villains have been raised from anxieties within British society right now, and ways that people respond to what happens once Article 50 is triggered in these very sort of crucial next couple of years.
I had a dream. a dream about you, baby. It's gonna come true, baby. They think that we're through, but baby, you'll be swell, you'll be great. Honey, everything's coming up roses. Now's your inning. Stand the world on its ear. Set it spinning. That'll be just the beginning. Turn up, light the lights. You've got nothing to hit but the heights. Well, you'll be great. I can tell, just you wait. That lucky star I talk about is due. Honey, everything's coming up. Roses for me and for you. You can. A hand, we can do it. Mama is gonna see to it. Curtain up, light the lights. We got nothing to hit but the heights. I can tell, wait and see. There's the bell, follow me.
Was the legendary Ethel Merman belting out "Everything's Coming Up Roses" from Sondheim's Gypsy, and which leads us neatly, I think, into a final question to the panel, which is, given the various historical perspectives we've been thinking about in relation to Brexit, do you think we can have a positive prognosis about where things are going from here, or a negative one, or do we simply not know? Do you want to go first, Ian, and we'll go down the
okay. Well, as my colleague Christine was saying, one of the obvious things about the whole debate in the referendum in 2016 was that it did, both sides presented, I think, an exaggerated kind of cartoon version of their cases. And, you know, the Remain case was basically economic catastrophe would immediately follow a vote to leave. And the Leave case was that, you know, utopia would arrive as soon as Britain voted to leave. Neither, I think, is likely to happen, and neither has happened. And the usual outcome of great political debates in democracies is that mostly both sides are disappointed. And I think that's probably what's going to happen here. The Remainers will be disappointed because we voted to leave. I think many Leave voters will be disappointed because I think many of the outcomes that they expect from a Leave vote are very unlikely to happen. Even at very kind of basic levels, for instance, the idea that Britain will obtain more powers to control immigration doesn't necessarily mean there will be less immigration.
Philippa.
Yeah, I think if you, as a medievalist here, who knows nothing about modern history, of course, nothing past about 1300, if you look at medieval history, if you insist on going back to the Charter of the Forest, we're talking about negotiation. All medieval disputes really end in negotiated settlements. And the Charter of the Forest shows, again, negotiated settlements mean nobody actually gets what they want. Nobody is happy at the end of it.
Better not tell the government. Sarah?
Thank you. I mean, the area which I'm going to be observing with a lot of interest is what happens in Scotland, because of its very, very strong Remain vote. And, you know, historians have, I mean, John McKenzie, for example, has been tracing the way in which Scots have constantly sought something to bolster them against England, whether it's the old alliance with France or then in the Empire. He argues that that was about Scotland finding a place for itself to shore up itself against the English. And again, the EU provided that for some time, and it was and so therefore I think this is going to be a very complex sort of series of negotiations there, when there's a very, very strong case for now people who had really were never going to be SNP supporters before are now very much pro independence in Scotland, to an extent which has never been the case before. And I think again there the constant need for Scots to feel like they're being dragged along by the South, I think will play out in potentially in very interesting ways, and will potentially lead to further devolution or an incredibly tense relationship where Scots continue to feel like the smaller partner in all of this.
As someone who lived many years in Scotland, I should be watching that as well. Rachel?
I think, as Ian said before, a lot of Leave voters who did vote on the issue of immigration will be quite disappointed to see that immigration just does suddenly stop overnight. And I think, as we've already been seeing since the referendum result, this could potentially lead to sort of an increase in racial attacks at towards European people.
Thank you. And last but by no means least, Christine.
I think I'll say that I am curious to see the impact on the economy, because as Ian has said, you know, we have yet to see any sort of actual economic impact, and the British economy has been quite robust in the face of all of this. But I think, you know, the biggest question mark really is, for me, and as a Canadian living in the UK, but very much always attentive to my former southern neighbours, the big question is Donald Trump and what a Brexit landscape where this kind of, you know, this Anglo sort of sphere that Sarah was talking about, how can that possibly play out with what seems to be quite a chaotic administration in the US, but which itself is not causing major sort of concerns within the stock market either. So that both of these powers who are facing such political instability right now are not yet feeling any sort of economic instability. So I'll be curious I'll be keeping an eye out on that as we go forth.
Well, I think that's all we've got time for with this edition. I'd like to thank all my colleagues from the School of History and Heritage, Dr. Ian Packer, Professor Philip Hoskin, Dr. Sarah Longyear, Dr. Christine Grandy, and Dr. B. Rachel Yem, and also my colleague Alex Zuk from Siren FM and the School of English and Journalism for taking care of the technical aspects and helping to get this show on the road. And we hope to be back with you with another edition in a month's time. Goodbye.
They say the next big thing is here, that the revolution's near. But to me it seems quite clear that it's all just a little bit of history repeating. The newspapers shout. A new style is growing, but it don't know if it's coming.